Your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day for conservatives, it seems to me, because of a number of decisions that have been coming down from the Supreme Court. Now, you may say, well, wait a second. The court decided by a 7-2 margin that they were not going to mess with Obamacare and strike it down, as many conservative attorneys general had been hoping. Why is that good news for conservatives? Well, it's good news politically, and it's also good news for winning a crucial argument, about packing the courts and politicization of the courts, where this is one of those clear arguments where conservatives win, progressives lose. They're wrong. They've been proven to be wrong. And it should be a sad day for some celebration for people who believe in an originalist approach to the Constitution. The big case handed down today, of course, was a case of religious liberty, a case of Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia that was trying to help people. And for their trouble, they got slapped with a lawsuit, even though they had never turned down anybody as a foster parent. It was just that they had a policy to limit their sponsored foster parenthood to couples who were a man and a woman. We'll get into some of the details of these cases. And speaking of Philadelphia, there's a new book that we're going to be talking about that actually most of it is set in and around Philadelphia. It's by somebody from that area, from Wilmington, Delaware, as a matter of fact, who's achieved great success as a sports entrepreneur. He was the senior partner in the Orlando Magic. Yes, I am broadcasting today live, my last day in this broadcast week, broadcasting from Orlando, Florida, where I'm here and speaking tomorrow morning early for the Faith and Freedom Coalition. And I'm speaking about why America needs more gratitude, less guilt. And we'll see about whether we get guilt or celebration or what we get with the first celebration tomorrow, it turns out, of the new federal holiday. Yippee, 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 yippee. It is called Juneteenth Independence Day. Now, what the heck is that supposed to mean? There were four Republicans, including some thoughtful Republicans like Chip Roy of Texas, who voted no on this bill. And I guess that's kind of a courageous vote, but I don't think it's a very smart vote because the sentiment publicly is overwhelming. First of all, people love the idea of another day off. Secondly, this is clearly some recognition about the effort to overcome slavery. And if it's done right, and basically they honor all of the people, white and black and here in America and around the world, who worked against slavery. And we talk about this epic in the human story, not just the United States, but how long a struggle it was for humanity to rid itself of this curse, this evil institution of slavery. Okay, fine, fair enough, because the American role in that was heroic, actually. And I think there's every reason to assume that the Juneteenth holiday, as it evolves, is going to take on a positive aspect of, as to the decision made to actually begin the holiday tomorrow. That's because the bill that was passed overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives, with only 14 members of the 435 voting no, because the bill was supposed to stipulate that if Juneteenth fell on a weekend day, then in order to make sure that people actually did get a holiday, did get a day off, that would be the Friday before the weekend. So tomorrow is actually June 18th. It is not June 19th, but we are all going to be celebrating Juneteenth. And I mean, I guess right now, coming out of the pandemic and things feeling a little bit better, we can celebrate that, use another day of celebration. And speaking of a day of celebration, there's a dire warning from the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland, and the President of the United States, the whole Biden administration, indicating that the biggest threat we face as a country right now is a movement of white supremacy. Is that even vaguely true? And I think there is a real problem of the Biden administration maybe buying into that preposition, that proposition, far too much, and not dealing with some of our real and more direct and more serious threats. For instance, here is a testimony from earlier this week by the Attorney General of the United States, Merrick Garland. And he was speaking about the greatest threat that we face at the moment. Listen.
The number of open FBI domestic terrorism investigations this year has increased significantly. According to an unclassified summary of the March intelligence assessment, the two most lethal elements of the domestic violence extremist threat are racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists and militia violent extremists. In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocate for the superiority of the white race.
Okay, really? Really? Now, when he talks about the top domestic threat to the United States, and of course, that's what the FBI is charged with. The FBI is not supposed to be looking at foreign threats so much unless they come to the United States. That's this division between the FBI and the CIA. And that hasn't always worked out so well. It certainly didn't work out so well in keeping us safe during the horrors of September 11th. But the idea that there is now this preoccupation with domestic terror, this goes along with a front page story about the condition of a lot of what people would consider to be right-wing, even right supremacist organizations. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting those organizations are really falling apart. They got terrible publicity, as they deserve to get, for sacking the White House. And the more that people continue to focus on that, it seems to me, the less credible, the less even defensible any of these organizations will be. I note that CNN is doing a big spectacular over the weekend where they're promising still more never-before-seen footage of the horrors in the Capitol building. And yes, I think the January 6th thing was terrible. But to now focus on that as a number one threat, the New York Times reports the Biden administration this week unveiled a national strategy to combat domestic extremism, calling the aggressive steps such as hiring for more intelligence analysts and screening government employees for ties to hate groups. The 32-page plan highlights a shift in the government's approach to counterterrorism, which for decades has prioritized fighting foreign terrorists. But violent attacks by American extremists are growing, a problem laid bare by the deadly Capitol riot on January 6th. Look, the deadly Capitol riot was horrible. It was destructive. It cost the government money. It sent police officers to the hospital. It traumatized the country. But think about it. Was this an organized terror attack in any sense? Was this really an attempted? How many people were arrested for gun violations? And the guns that were fired with deadly effect, was a gunshot against Ashley Babbitt, who was trying to. And by the way, I think it was entirely appropriate for a Capitol police officer to shoot at her when she was coming after members of Congress. That's his job. And the idea that this represents something that we need to spend a great deal more money on, where have we had illustrations of an organized domestic terror threat involving white supremacy? We will get to that. Also, a new book about leadership lessons from our founding fathers and particularly revolutionary commanders. That and more coming up on the MedVed Show. Michael Medved show. Look, I am not one to say that we should rest easy about any form of terror, any form of crime. But at a time when crime is going so crazy all across the country, it's not just Chicago. That's especially Chicago. And the mayor of Chicago, Lori Lightfoot, now says she needs federal help to keep peace in her own city. And she needs tighter gun laws. Okay, Chicago already has some of the tightest gun laws in the country. What they don't have is a means to enforce those laws, worthy as they may be, or unworthy as they may be, to actually protect the people in Chicago who are suffering every blasted week. And then in San Francisco, you hear that they closed 17 Walgreens stores. 17, it's a lot of stores, right? They close these stores because there's too much shoplifting and the police can't do anything about it. This is a real problem. Everybody saw that viral video of the jerk coming in on his bicycle, knocking stuff off shelves into a big plastic trash bag and then riding off with it as a security guard kind of waves at him. She tried to grab the bag. But nobody wants to be the next encounter that could be fatal for the perpetrator, or could be fatal for the guard or the police officer, or anything like that. And the police officer, by the way, asked police department in San Francisco, asked about this now very famous example of shoplifting. What do they say? They say, we have not made any progress on the case. Well, they have a video of this that has been seen all over the world. And with this going on within our own country, and with a very aggressive possibilities of cyber attacks and every other kind of disaster from the Soviet Union, and with, as I'm going to point out to you, a complete reluctance on the part of this administration to try to raise our naval spending in particular. Look, at least they haven't cut back on the defense spending altogether. But right now, with China moving forward so dramatically to expand its navy in a very aggressive and threatening way, we got to do something more about it. And instead, we're talking about this sweeping attempt to go after white supremacist terrorists and radical right-wing groups in America. I have no love for those groups. I have no respect for those groups. But this, it seems to me, is an expansion of government that serves no real purpose. And Merrick Garland said in his speech that the strategy aims to coordinate efforts across the government. Good. It outlines four priorities. Number one, improving information sharing among law enforcement agencies. Yeah, talk to each other, guys. Maybe somebody should have actually gotten that information from the FBI about what they were planning to do on January 6th. They didn't. Number one, they say improving information sharing among law enforcement agencies. Preventing recruitment by extremist groups. How do you prevent recruitment by extremist groups? I'll tell you one way you don't do it, by talking about them all the time. It gives them credibility. And again, it hurts recruitment by extremist groups when you have a piece like you had in the Wall Street Journal today about Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and the Boogaloo Boys kind of falling apart, which is an appropriate thing. Then they say that they want investigating such groups and confronting the longstanding drivers of domestic terrorism, racism, and bigotry. Okay, basically, is that why we're going to have this new federal holiday tomorrow? Is that to confront domestic terrorism and bigotry? We cannot promise that we will be able to disrupt every plot, defuse every bomb, or arrest every co-conspirator because they managed to wreak unspeakable, before they managed to wreak unspeakable horror. But we can promise that we will do everything in our power to prevent such tragedy. So said the Attorney General of the United States, the Honorable Merrick B. Garland. That's what he said in an address at the Justice Department's Great Hall. The administration also requested over $100 million in new spending for the Justice Department to hire prosecutors, investigators, and analysts. Okay, political problem is not new. A warning in a 2009 Homeland Security report that military veterans returning from combat could be vulnerable to recruitment by terrorist groups or extremists prompted backlash from conservatives, forcing the Homeland Security Secretary at the time, Janet Napolitano, to apologize and retract the report. An edited version was eventually issued, but the political risks of highlighting far-right extremism were clear. It's not the problem of highlighting far-right extremism. I remember that controversy. I was one of those people on the air who bashed that report. Why? Because it implied that there was something wrong with our veterans. It implied that people who had served their country in Iraq and Afghanistan were somehow more subject to this kind of craziness that they're talking about. But almost all of it is prospective. It has been years since we've had large bloody confrontations, have we, that involve the far right? Now, I'm not now talking here about a lone wolf killer like this guy Buford, who came into the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and murdered 11 people, or the Dylan Roof, who killed the 9 people in the basement of Charleston Church while they were at Bible study. People had invited him in to study the book with them. But the idea that we have crazy people, that we need protection, doesn't go to the point that we are now seeing a huge surge in right-wing violence. This is like yesterday's, you may remember, alarm bells about this huge surge of anti-Asian hate crime. Look, I understand. I know that people are more conscious of it because there's more publicity about it. And it's a terrible thing when people are socked on the street or told to go home from where you've been. And yes, it's appropriate for the government to try to do something about it. But this entire plea by the Biden administration comes at the same time, same day, in fact, that there's a Wall Street Journal editorial under the heading Threats Rise, Defense Falls. President Biden is telling the world in Europe this week that America is back as the leader of global democracies. Sounds good, but China, Iran, and Vladimir Putin would be more impressed if Mr. Biden wasn't cutting America's defense, even as he rightly stresses the challenge from the world's authoritarians. We will get more to that and some leadership lessons that Joe Biden and other American leaders might take from some of our founding fathers, including a bunch you may never have heard of. There's a terrific new book, and so by someone who's written over 100 new books, and this one is about leadership lessons from the heroes of the American Revolution. We'll get to that talking to Pat Williams coming right up on the MedVed Show.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
It's an honor to talk to you because I think you got the best talk show in the United States.
Thank you. I agree.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there's a new book that I was handed yesterday, and I actually stayed up a little bit last night reading it, and it's extraordinarily readable, and it's actually very important. It's by a guy named Pat Williams, who I've just had the privilege of meeting, and he's sitting across the table from me here in Orlando, Florida, and he's best known, perhaps, as the now-retired senior vice president of the NBA's Orlando Magic. And I understand in that capacity you had something to do with the launching the career of Mr. O'Neal.
Whoa, Shaq. 1992, Michael, we drafted him. We won the first pick in the lottery that year, and here was this big giant coming out of LSU after his junior year. And everybody knew he was going to be a special talent and a unique personality. And fortunately, the ping pong balls bounced our way that day in 1992. And as a result, Shaq started his career here in Orlando. So we have vivid memories of him.
Of course you do. Not just memories. He's a vivid personality on an ongoing basis. But basketball wasn't your original sport. Your original sport seems to have been baseball.
That's true, Mike. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware, and I was near the Philadelphia Phillies. The Philadelphia Athletics were both in Philly then, and I was a baseball nut.
Yeah, and so was I, and I was also a Phillies nut.
You were born in Philadelphia.
And I started rooting for the Phillies consciously when they were at last place virtually every year. They had that 23-game losing streak.
Yes.
That was epic, and then blew the world the chance for the pennant in 1964. Long suffering Phillies fan, like you.
I know the feeling. My roots started, you're right, Michael, in baseball. I spent the first 7 years of my career in the Phillies organization. I was a minor league catcher in Miami for 2 years, and then ran minor league ball clubs in the Phillies farm system for 5 seasons.
Wow.
And then, surprisingly, I left baseball in the fall of 1968 and went to Philadelphia to work for the 76ers and spent 51 years in the NBA.
Wow. Okay, there's something else that you went to Philadelphia for when you were growing up. And boy, boy, this resonated with me a lot when I was reading your book. My dad used to take me to Valley Forge, to Independence Hall, to the Brandywine Battlefield, which you reference in the book directly. And really going to these places where this amazing, changing, world-changing events occurred can really stay with you for a lifetime. And what you're writing about here is why, at a time when so many Americans are downcast and sour about our country, reading the story of some of these revolutionary leaders that you profile in your book, Revolutionary Leadership, the subtitle is Essential Lessons from the Men and Women of the American Revolution. This can really lift the spirits, don't you think? We need.
Oh, Michael, I want people to be proud of our country. It's the greatest nation on earth.
Well, and this story.
And how it started.
Yeah, that story of how it started is so extraordinary. In doing this book, was there one of these revolutionary heroes in particular who surprised you?
Well, there were a number of them, Michael. I came away so impressed with Henry Knox and Nathaniel Greene. Let me talk for a minute about Lafayette. 19 years old, Frenchman, heard about the revolution, comes over here by himself. Knew nobody, and lands on a wharf somewhere off the coast of South Carolina, wended his way north, and found George Washington somehow. That alone was miraculous. Washington didn't know him, but Washington saw something in him that there was a little spark there. And they developed almost a father-son relationship. And he put Lafayette right in the middle of things.
What should we learn from Lafayette's experience? He, after all, was a French aristocrat.
Yes.
He was somebody of great money and privilege. What leadership lesson can we take away from him?
Every now and then you got to take a big risk. That was an enormous risk for this 19-year-old kid to hop on a boat and come across the Atlantic and arrive somewhere on the shores of this new country. Huge risk.
And you talk about Henry Knox. Henry Knox was a bookseller in Boston.
Yes.
And he was heavy. He was he was not a slender, athletic guy.
He
was a heavy, bookish guy. But he actually learned a great deal of what he learned about being the artillery chief in the Revolution and the first ever Secretary of War under President Washington later. He learned it all from books, didn't he?
He did. And there's another lesson, Michael, and that's the importance of being a reader. It was Harry Truman who said, not all readers will be leaders, but all leaders must be readers of good books.
That's a great line. I had not heard that before.
And Knox, you see, had a brilliant mind. But when the war started, and this I still can't fathom this. When the war started, Henry Knox volunteered his services, and there had been a victory for the colonies up in Fort Ticonderoga, and there, as a result, there was a ton of weaponry up there, a massive amount. And the question was, as the British were closing in on Boston, how do we get that weaponry down here to Boston to help stave it off? And Henry Knox said, I got an idea. I'll go up there. We'll get sleds and we'll get horses and oxen and we'll tug it all down here in the dead of winter over frozen ponds and frozen lakes. But Michael, somehow or other, they got all that military equipment down there and set it up on the hillside. And the British saw it and said, uh-oh, that doesn't look good. We're out of here. And they went to New York, of course, but Boston was spared.
Well, that's one of the, that's the first great victory that gave George Washington mm-hmm. his prestige right after he had taken over. Okay, in the very small amount of time we have left.
Yes.
Not all these heroes spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
Baron von Steuben, who came over here from Germany, he was not one of the Hessians. He wasn't a mercenary. He was someone who was doing it by belief. What did he teach by training the army at Valley Forge?
Well, there they were at Valley Forge, Michael, just suffering through that winter. And von Steuben arrived, very colorful character, outspoken, foul-mouthed, didn't speak much English. And he took these troops who were just hanging around these wooden huts, and he put them to work and started teaching them how to be a soldier, how to march, how to carry a weapon, how to drill and drill and drill and drill. And these young soldiers began to adapt. They began to get into this.
Sounds like some professional sports coaches you may name.
He probably was like that. And von Steuben deserves an awful lot of credit. Washington was brilliant at taking these different people and plugging them in somewhere where their skills would be best utilized. He wanted help. He was not a guy that wanted to hog everything. He was not a limelight guy.
He knew how to delegate,
yes.
And you knew how to describe these personalities. The book, which is has a foreword by my friend Brian Kilmeade, and it has recommendations by Mike Huckabee and Nick Saban and Adam Silver of the NBA and Ben Carson, our former housing secretary. The book is highly readable. It is called Revolutionary Leadership. We'll post on our website essential lessons from the men and women of the American Revolution. May we have only successful revolutions and changes. Pat Williams, thanks for joining us, and thanks for this great contribution and great nighttime or daytime reading.
Thank
we'll
you, Michael.
We'll be right back on the Medved Show.
Great to be with you.
Thank you.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
I really enjoy your program. I listen to talk radio all day. You're definitely right up there, the cream of the crop.
This is The Michael Medved Show.
Michael Medved Show, there is lots and lots of conversation going on in Washington about infrastructure. But the Wall Street Journal, as we are talking about earlier this hour, raises the question, what about defense infrastructure? They write that unremarked in the White House spending deluge is that its trillions for infrastructure, in quotes, include little new for defense. Mr. Biden's $715 billion Pentagon budget for fiscal 2022 is a 1.6% increase over last year. Adjusted for inflation, this is a cut. We have more than 1.6% inflation now. So this means there's actually less money available for buying equipment, for modernizing, for the troops, for everything. And it's a serious matter at a time of world danger when both Russia and particularly China are spending very aggressively to build up their military and increasingly trying to cooperate to diminish the role or the presence, influence of the United States. The Bipartisan National Defense Strategy Commission and other experts say the Pentagon needs steady 3% to 5% real increases every year to address threats from near peers such as China and Russia. President Trump increased defense spending modestly, but that fillip has passed and spending is still at its modern norm of about 3% of GDP. You hear so many people think we spend most of our federal budget on defense. That, of course, is nonsense. 97% of total spending, including things like all of the social spending and like interest on the national debt, which, of course, is increasing even when the interest rates are not because the debt is increasing, that we are still at 3% at a moment of real peril. And again, people talking seriously about a confrontation with Iran, confrontation with North Korea, confrontation with China, with Russia not so much, but still a cyber confrontation could be serious enough. President Trump increased defense spending modestly, writes the Wall Street Journal. But that has passed, and spending is still at its modern norm of about 3% of GDP. America is rapidly piling up debt past 100% of GDP while shrinking our defenses. Nowhere is underinvestment clearer than in the stormy forecast for the U.S. Navy, writes the Journal. At roughly 300 ships, the Navy soon won't have the size or capability to compete with a more than 350-ship fleet China is minting. In April, China reportedly commissioned 3 warships in a day. That's an amazing thing when you think about it. Okay, why does this matter? Because America is just about the only power in the world. I won't say just about. It's the only power in the world that really does need a two-ocean navy. Because our security is menaced on the Atlantic, on our Atlantic coast, and very much on our Pacific coast. That's why, for the United States of America, there was necessary war on 2 fronts in World War II. And could that happen again? I'd look at the map. It's not unthinkable, and it's extraordinarily important that we be prepared. In April, China reportedly commissioned 3 warships in a day, says a journal. The Navy's 2022 proposal would hasten the retirement of 2 cruisers to save some money. The Navy would procure 8 ships. Only 4 are combat ships. The request for the shipbuilding account is down about 3% from last year's level. The Navy is worried about readiness, particularly overworked carriers, and that a larger fleet won't be properly managed or maintained, which are real concerns. And that is a case for more investment. A consensus in Congress agrees that the Navy should grow to 355 ships, but the officer briefing reporters on the defense budget conceded that with a 300-ship Navy and a 30-year life, you have to recapitalize at 10% per year, and so 8 is just not going to do it. The Biden team says it will divest to invest or send about $2.8 billion in old stuff to the boneyard to free up dollars for more modern equipment. As ships and planes age, they become expensive and time-consuming to maintain, draining readiness accounts, and the military does need to spend more on innovation like hypersonic missiles. Now, what does all this mean? People should get some sense of it and take a look. There's a book co-written by Admiral Stavridis, who was a 4-star admiral in the Navy, and he's written a book called 2032, which talks about a naval war with Japan. 2034, pardon me. He talks about a naval war with China, at a time when the Chinese have achieved just by building so many ships. Now, there are people who are defense experts who say, doesn't matter how many ships the Chinese put out to sea, they're not equal to what we can put out to sea. Ours are of much better quality. Our technology is better. One of the things that basically people say you have to look at when you look at China is that assumption that their technology is inferior and we don't have to worry about it because, after all, they are using every means they possibly can to steal our more advanced technology. Those are not really very reassuring thoughts when you look at even the near future. And in the near future, the idea of a confrontation over Taiwan, over Japan. Japan is undertaking a major job of shipbuilding. And right now, that the people say, well, what's the use of all this? The use of all this is not to win wars, it's to deter wars by making victory virtually certain. It's peace through strength, and it has been shown to work. And this is an issue where if Joe Biden is throwing in $100 million new dollars to try to improve communications about a truly handful of crazies and fringe people and the domestic right, and yet we are cutting back, in effect, what we are spending on our defense, and particularly on our Navy, that, it seems to me, is a very legitimate concern, and it is a legitimate point to raise in the upcoming campaign. By the way, President Trump did announce that he is going to be doing a series of rallies over the summer. The mission, apparently, will be largely to help Republicans win back control of the House and the Senate. In Ohio, President Trump will hold his first post-presidency rally on June 26th. What are we talking about? We're talking about a week from Saturday. And that will be in Wellington, Ohio, for a former Trump administrative official named Max Miller, who is challenging Representative Anthony Gonzalez, who's a Republican moderate, in the primary. Gonzalez was one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach the former president. I mean, I think it's good luck on the primary to both contenders. It is a terrible shame when in a district that isn't a completely sure district, and that district emphatically is not, if Republicans go after each other and hand the seat over to a Democrat. Later in the show, we'll talk a little bit about the two big Supreme Court decisions today and about the apparent contradiction between the decision on religious liberty in behalf of Catholic Social Services in Philadelphia and the case of poor Jack Phillips, who's been a guest on this show, the famous baker in Colorado, who is being not just prosecuted but persecuted over the fact that he doesn't want to bake cakes to celebrate somebody's gender reassignment. And again, it's not that he says, no, I won't serve trans people. He'll serve a trans person to do whatever kind of cake he or she wants, but just not one that sends that message. Should that really be the subject of prosecution and persecution? It shouldn't be in this greatest nation on God's green earth.